I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Justin Dyer, professor of government and Jack G. Taylor Regents Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. We're discussing his recent book, The Classical and Christian Origins of American Politics, Political Theology, Natural Law, and the American Founding, from Cambridge University Press. Dyer's research is on American political thought, jurisprudence, and constitutionalism, with an emphasis on natural law theory. He is the author of several books and many articles on these topics. Well, first of all, Justin Dyer, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Justin, this is a great book. Very much enjoyed it, along with your co-author, Cody Cooper. It's a great analysis of the sort of theological background, particularly Christian theological background of American founding. Walk through some crucial moments and crucial thinkers in that early history. I applaud you for the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
You know, in some ways, the motivation goes back to my time in graduate school at the University of Texas. And I had written a dissertation on natural law and anti-slavery constitutionalism. One of my dissertation committee members later sent me a note, and he said that it was great, congratulations, all of those things, and then said, but I still don't think that you take seriously enough the idea that the God of nature is not the God of Abraham. And not only that, but the law of nature is not an adjunct to, but a rival to the divine law. And then he followed up by saying, if you think differently, there's an article or book waiting to be written. And so I had been thinking about it for a while, and Cody Cooper, my co-author, is an old friend, and we were thinking about these questions together for a long time, going back to, we overlapped in graduate school. And so we had co-authored together on this topic several different times and decided to pull it together into this book project where we're really tackling that. And the conclusion that I end up coming to is that after consideration, the God of nature is not the God of Abraham, that there's a certain compatibility with that framing and with the Christian theological traditions that are dominant in the American founding, and that these two things are not at odds with each other, and certainly were not in the thinking of the founders.
Yeah, that's great. So, right. I mean, this is helpful in terms of the thesis, that it's not a, your thesis is not that it's, you know, the American founding is best understood, or the principles behind the American founding is not best understood as specific, it must be understood in Christian theological terms. It's more, the thrust is more of a negative argument, I take it, right? That is that it's not, that there's a view out there, and maybe you could start with this, that a kind of standard scholarly view that the one that you just articulated from your committee member, that there's a certain incompatibility between, you know, sort of secular approaches to natural rights and sort of Christian theological approaches, which goes to the heart of a certain reading of modernity in general. That is, that, you know, sort of modern political thought, at least in some of its aspirations, seeks to kind of liberate human beings from the chains of religion, certain strands of the Enlightenment, for example. So is that, I mean, I guess, first of all, is that, you know, is that the right kind of reading in terms of, you know, what your aims are? And then maybe you can sort of shift into the case for that reading that you're kind of combating.
Yeah, it's responsive to a particular reading that is influential in academic circles, and I think among political theorists in particular. There's a way of reading the history of political thought so that modernity represents this rupture from a classical past and instantiates new ideas about God and God's relationship to the world and the political order. And so the modern break from that past represents something that's really in tension with it. And so to put a finer point on it, you know, this secular reading of the founding would say that the founders are part of that modern project. And what that modern project is doing is using language that sounds compatible with Christianity, but really is not. and it's undermining and it's subversive of that Christian tradition. And so the representation of that is by appeals to nature and nature's God. Matthew Stewart, the philosopher, has a book called Nature's God, and the subtitle is The Heretical Origins of American Constitutionalism or Politics, something like that. And it points to this idea, as he reads it, that there's a kind of atheistic underpinning to these appeals to nature, pantheistic underpinning to these appeals to nature, that God and nature are one and the same thing, that if we're just talking about the rational organizing principle of the universe that is subsumed within and part of the universe, we're no longer talking about a creator that creates ex nihilo like you get in the Christian tradition. And so that's the point at which political theorists often look at the American founding as a break from that past. And you might associate that view with someone like Thomas Hobbes, and we do in the book. If you go a little bit deeper, you might associate that with Spinoza, and we don't talk about Spinoza much in the book, but certain political theorists would point to him as, and I think Matthew Stewart does in his book, point to Spinoza as somehow really the brains behind the operation when you get to the American founding. And so we're pushing back against that thesis. And that maybe sets up an easy case for us, or an easier case than something a little bit more nuanced. But I think that stark reading of the American founding is really helpful to understand what we're up to in this book.
Yeah, but I mean, just one last question, just to sort of push you on this point. Is it the case that you think that the principles of the American founding and the American Constitution must appeal to some sort of transcendent principle, right? That they're kind of unintelligible outside of that. You're just sort of agnostic in terms of it doesn't have to be necessarily Christian or some other view, but
Yeah, so
I guess how would you address that?
we're doing two things. So what we're doing is we're taking that thesis as a challenge, and as it was a challenge. If you disagree with that, there's an article, Book Waiting to Britain, and so we've put this together. And so what is our thesis exactly? Ours is twofold. One is that if we take an analytic look at the founding, if we lay out what we would consider to be a classical and Christian approach to the natural law tradition, what core elements would be there? And in the introduction, we lay out eight separate things that we think would be core elements of that tradition. And then we look at the primary sources in the founding that are dominant in places like the pamphlet debates leading up to the Revolution, and some of the debates over the Constitution, and some of the primary writings of some of the founders. And what we see is, just from that analytic approach, that they're compatible with that classical and Christian tradition. But there's also a descriptive case to be made that the natural law tradition that is influential in the founding era is in broad continuity with a tradition that comes forward from the ancient pagans, but is changed in all sorts of ways by its encounter with Christianity and with Christian thinkers. And something that I think is important to our case is that tradition, that natural law tradition that we see, is passed on through the Reformation to the Protestant theological traditions that are influential in the American founding. And so we're arguing that that tradition is one of the dominant influences on the founders. And it would be a mistake, I think. We mentioned the multiple traditions thesis that a lot of people have today. And scholars who are interpreting the founding will often highlight the liberal tradition and the republican tradition, the Scottish Enlightenment and the common law, and various traditions like that. And what we're saying is not that the classical Christian natural law tradition is somehow another tradition alongside all of those. It's actually a tradition that is influencing each one of those various strands in different ways. And we think that that's an important part of understanding the founding. And to really see that clearly, we try to juxtapose that with the alternative. What would it look like if it were truly rejecting those elements that we think are an important aspect of that classical tradition? And our argument is that you just don't see that in the founding sources.
Yeah, I mean, you don't go into some of the intellectual influences on the American founding, but you just mentioned the sort of Protestant influence. I don't know if you could say just a little bit about the kind of thinkers that you have in mind, sort of that are in the background. I mean, some of this has been territory explored elsewhere, is sort of the intellectual influences on the American founders. But typically people point to thinkers like Locke or Montesquieu. I mean, these are thinkers, of course, who have their own kind of literature that's grown up around them in terms of how to what degree should we understand these thinkers as fighting against a sort of religious influence or religious figures themselves. I mean, so do you, I mean, where do you see the sort of lion's share of the sort of intellectual influence, intellectual and theological influence on the American founders?
So part of what we're arguing is not about the various contours of Christianity or how Christianity has changed in the modern era, but it's about this natural law tradition, one aspect that was broadly accepted within Christendom and influential in the founding era. But you had mentioned these other sources, and we do look at the sources that seem to be influential. John Locke, of course, is one of those. And we note that Donald Lutz has this article that you might be familiar with in the 1980s, where he does a quantitative analysis of founding era sources that are appealed to in the various political tracts, and he excludes political sermons from the sample. And it's interesting what appears, but in various eras of the debates, different authors are more influential than others. I think arguably Montesquieu becomes much more influential than Locke, just in terms of numbers of citations in different periods. But more than all of those citations combined was the Book of Deuteronomy. And so you have a frequent recurrence to the Bible, certainly within the founders. And there are several books recently by people who have explored all of the different ways that the founders interacted with and appealed to and invoked scripture within their political writings. But even something like that, I think, is a false, could be a false dichotomy if we think about Protestantism or John Locke. You know, if you go to Christ Church in Oxford, John Locke is buried there. And he was certainly known among his contemporaries to be a Protestant thinker, and nobody would have categorized him as something else. So when the American founders are appealing to Locke, or when the clergymen in the American founding are appealing to Locke, it's not as though they were consciously appealing to something unchristian. Of course, there are, I think, within the history of political philosophy in the United States as it's studied, scholars are deeply influenced by Leo Strauss's reading of Locke. And there's a way in which I think we often read back into the American founders the same kind of understanding. And so, one common way of reading Locke is that Locke was an esoteric writer. And in his esotericism, he was pointing to something that looks a lot like Thomas Hobbes's political philosophy. And that represents the kind of secular approach to political philosophy. Whether or not Strauss is right about that, I don't think it's the case that the founders read Locke that way. And so that's one of the important things that we're doing, is we're not asking what's the right or the true interpretation of Locke, or what's the right and true interpretation of Hobbes. And Cody and I disagree on Hobbes. He has his own book and thesis about how to interpret Hobbes. But instead, we just ask how the founders read these people. What do they actually say? And if we look at their writings, how does that match up with the analytic framework that we put together to try to really test these claims?
Yeah, that's good. So let's talk about some of the moments that you mention, because it is a, I mean, the founders are a mixed bag, and you have on the one extreme kind of Ben Franklin, and on the other extreme maybe a James Wilson. So it's sort of a wide array of different individuals here with regard to their religious views. Maybe I could, well, maybe, I guess before we jump in, can I just ask you? I mean, just, you have a series, of sort of analyses from, you could say, the pre-revolutionary period up through 1790s. How did you make your selection in terms of thinking about the particular thinkers or moments in the American founding to do the analysis?
The moments proceed chronologically. And so we start with the pamphlet debates leading up to the revolution. We think about revolutionary language and the Declaration of Independence as a kind of culmination of those pamphlet debates. We look at constitutional arguments about popular sovereignty and how we should understand the Constitution. And then we also consider individual figures, and we take up two separate challenges. One is Thomas Jefferson on one side and James Wilson on another, similar to your framing about Benjamin Franklin and James Wilson. Thomas Jefferson represents the most, I don't know if most unorthodox, but certainly an unorthodox view with respect to his religious beliefs, and one that we would consider to be the most skeptical of the founders or of some of the dominant founders. We take Jefferson as a challenge to our thesis. You know, if we really think that people are influenced by this classical and Christian tradition, would it be true of Thomas Jefferson, somebody who was certainly not an Orthodox Christian and mocked certain Christian doctrines? And then on the other extreme of this would be James Wilson, who was fairly outwardly pious as an individual and in his rhetoric. But nonetheless, there are readings of Wilson among political theorists that put him in that same secular and subversive camp and category. And so we take those two in turn and have case studies on Jefferson and Wilson. And then in our conclusion, we try to think through what all this means for contemporary politics. You know, we're living in a weird moment in American politics, and a lot of things seem to all be on the table again in all sorts of ways. And so we try to really think through what all of this has to say to our current moment.
Good. Yeah. So let's start with the pre-revolutionary pamphlet debates, and this is sort of debates that surrounded, some of the political activity that was going on before the Revolutionary War around, say, the Stamp Act, for example. And one of the things you point out here is that the debates drew on a kind of natural law, natural rights tradition, which had a kind of theological dimension. So maybe you could just say a little bit about, I mean, if you want to draw on, you focus mostly on James Otis and John Dickinson here. Maybe if you want to, just give us a brief discussion of how some of the sort of theological elements find their way into these debates.
Sure. Well, if it's not too boring for your listeners, can I go through the kind of analytic framework that we put together? Because this helps, I think. So if we're asking what a classical and Christian approach to natural law would be, what does that look like? And we lay out some specific things that we're looking for. And think about this as a kind of hypothesis, where we're laying this out as an analytic framework and then looking at the primary sources and seeing how they mesh with this. So the first thing would be that natural law has a lawgiver. And this lawgiver is a divine creator, and the creator is separate and distinct from creation. So we don't have a pantheistic understanding of the divine. The others that our reason will be able to understand certain moral goods that are proper to human nature. So there's a reflection on human nature and the goods associated with it. And based on this reflection, we understand certain obligations as being prescriptive and not just descriptive. So it's not just hypothetical imperatives, we actually have some moral obligations. And the founders actually talked a lot about the way that this would relate to theological debates over God's nature. And so the idea was that this natural law emanates from God's nature, and in God's nature, they argued, and you see this in even the moral philosophy classes at the colonial colleges and in James Wilson's lectures on law and in other places, that in God's nature, they said there was a unity of power and goodness. These two things are combined. And that was really important to them because they saw something like that in the human authority that comprises the political community, that just as God's authority comes from this unity of power and goodness, so does the political authority to be a rightly ordered or just political community. Those two elements need to be united, power and goodness. And so that's what the rule of law is. The rule of law means that the sovereign is subject to and bound by some higher moral law. And so this idea that might does not make right stems from that understanding. And so that would be true of political sovereignty if it was a kingship. It remains true of political sovereignty in a republic. And so the people are sovereign in a sense, but they're not absolutely sovereign, that there remains some higher law. And then God sustains in their rhetoric, and as they argued about this, God sustains and provides for this creation through the natural law and then through various exercises of divine providence. And natural law ends up being one part of that divine providence. So that's kind of broadly the tradition that we're describing. And if we go back and look at the pamphlet debates and compare the arguments that are being made with that tradition, those are the kinds of things that you find. You find appeals to natural law, appeals to reason, the idea of a moral reality, basic goods rooted in human nature. You have appeals to human authority that unites power and goodness, a critique of the way that that authority had been abused by the English sovereign. And then the stages of the pamphlet debates, they go in various stages where they're rejecting the idea that Parliament has authority over them. They develop a theory about their allegiance to the crown. This is why you get the charges against the king in the Declaration of Independence rather than charges against Parliament. They don't recognize Parliament's authority over them. And so all of these arguments, constitutional and political and recurrence to first principles within the pamphlet debates, I think all operate within this broader framework that we would put within this classical tradition. So what's the alternative? You know, if it's not that, you could take each one of those points and just kind of reverse them. If you don't have that tradition, if you're looking for something that would be more secular, it would be a rejection of each one of the things that I went through. And at least in, you know, in the primary sources and even in a lot of the private writings that you find at the founders, I just don't, we didn't see, you know, absent a few exceptions, maybe Ethan Allen or someone like that, you know, you get a few, but they're just not a lot of examples. So it's certainly not, the secular reading does not appear to us to be the dominant tradition.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I wanted to, if we could, sort of push ahead to Jefferson in part because I think he's the, you know, he's the challenged case for you as you mentioned. You know, for a couple different reasons. I mean, one is, you know, Jefferson was, you know, yeah, sort of famously critical view of the Bible, and didn't he have like a copy of the Bible that excerpted all the you know, miraculous parts of it. Right.
Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah, with all the
Yeah,
miracles.
right, exactly. And so it's a kind of natural theology, in other words. I mean, this is a, maybe one of the ways that I maybe would respond to your book, in the sense that even Jefferson, maybe if he held on to a kind of natural theology, it's not a kind of revealed theology. Maybe you could just say, you know, sort of walk through your view of Jefferson and how it sort of fits into that broad analytic framework that you laid out.
So we are not arguing that Jefferson was a Orthodox Christian or any, you know, we're not. I had a friend once say that was the rich man's David Barton. We're not trying to be that, you know. So we're not making the case for Jefferson as a serious Christian or anything like that. But our thesis doesn't depend on that, because what we're arguing is not that, you know, we're not even getting into people's individual religious beliefs, but we're talking about the tradition that remains influential even for people living downstream from it who may depart from Orthodox Christianity in some ways. But for Jefferson, or we might say even for Jefferson, certain core ideas like creation remain important. And so for Jefferson, his original rough draft of the Declaration of Independence includes the idea of our equal creation. And so that, you know, his original language still is rooting natural rights in the idea of a creator, and creation becomes extremely important for him in terms of how he understands natural rights republicanism. And so what we're trying to show is that even this fairly common and popular idea that the founders were deists is wrong if by deism you mean that there's a disinterested God who takes no care of the world and is not provident. They talk about providence all the time. And Jefferson often will reflect on questions of providence and questions of how God works in creation, and certainly believes in a natural moral order that could be understood based on reason. And so we're not, you know, I'm not saying that there's a one-to-one overlap in all of these things, but we do try to demonstrate that there are surprising continuities between this tradition and what you find even in somebody like Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, one other example I thought of in Jefferson was, and I'm not sure which letter it is, but he says something like, you know, what does it matter to me, you know, if somebody believes in eight gods or four gods or two gods or something, some such thing. I mean, I think I put in the context of, I guess you could say, Jefferson's views about toleration, with regard to religious views. And this is obviously a sort of inheritance from the Lockean tradition. I get it. Maybe you could speak to the issue of toleration here and the role that it played in the American founding, because I'm assuming it comes into some conflict with a kind of theological, approach to these issues. Because if you're going to have a theological approach to politics, there's at least a tendency to eschew monism or to eschew pluralism, right, with regard to religious beliefs. That it's sort of an additional move to step in the direction of religious toleration. That's religious toleration, in other words, is already a step on the way to secularization. Maybe put it that way.
Yeah, maybe.
So go ahead.
I was gonna say maybe there are two different ways of telling this story, and people tell it very differently. But the one version of this story is that Christianity and the Christian tradition leading into modernity has no room within it for claims of conscience or religious liberty, and certainly there would be no claim for religious toleration. And of course, we see horrendous bloodshed and the wars that tore Europe apart on just that question. And then when you get to the modern era, toleration becomes something that comes out of a secularization. But there's another way of thinking about this, which is that in the ancient world, of course, religious liberty was unknown as well, and there was a unity between the religious order and the political order, and that Christianity actually is what inaugurates a break between those two things, that the separation of church and state is, in some sense, a product of Christianity. And it's Jesus who says to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. And so within the Christian tradition, there had long been this analytic thinking that separates those two worlds. And then, of course, people have thought about how they relate to each other. But it's in modernity that you see them being reunited in people like Hobbes and Rousseau. And so one claim could be made, and I think there's an argument for this, that it's really Christianity that initially separates church and state and creates space for the argument that develops over time that religion can't be coerced. And you find that in some of the early church fathers, and you find that even in some of the medieval thinkers. And by the time you get to the Reformation and then the traditions that are influential in the American founding, this, of course, becomes one of the principal things that they're debating about. And you have both, I think, a theological case for religious liberty that develops over time within those Protestant traditions and a practical necessity for it because you have 13 different colonies with different traditions that are influential in those colonies, debates that are going on within the colonies and then later the states about state establishments and religious liberty, and then, of course, the question nationally about what they're going to be doing together. But I don't necessarily see that as secularization is leading to toleration. And I think, in fact, the arrow can point the other direction, where secularization necessitates that you have a state-established religion for the good of the unity and the peace and the order of the state that then actually does not allow for religious liberty. But in America, you get this really unique confluence of multiple theological denominations all trying to work together, broadly connected, but with their own differences, and the necessity of toleration. And then the arguments that you get from people like Jefferson. But Jefferson's not the only one making the argument, and some of the seriously religious people in the colonies are also making the religious case for religious toleration. So I think you see something very unique happening, and Tocqueville comments on this, that in America it looks like the friends of liberty and the friends of religion are the same. And it's a very helpful thing that's happening. But I don't think it would be totally accurate to say that the story is just that a secularizing trend away from Christianity is responsible for that.
Yeah, that's good. That's helpful. What about the role of revelation versus reason in this discussion? I mean, I guess I introduced this when thinking about Jefferson in general, that he was a strong critic of revelation, and instead pointed to reason as the sort of the only star and compass, for our thinking about these issues. I mean, is that How does that play within your, because again, I mean, one could say, you could tell a story that, the appeal simply to reason rather than to the miraculous is already a move in the direction of secularization.
Yeah, I think some of this is actually built into the theological framework that we're partly appealing to in this. So within the Christian tradition, and within the Protestant reformers, you get a framework where they talk about our natural knowledge of God the Creator and our revealed knowledge of God the Redeemer. And what they meant by that, operating from within their own theological framework or their own theological tradition, what they meant by that is that we know God as the Creator by reason. And by reason, then we can also deduce certain things about the world. This is natural theology, which was taught as part of the moral philosophy classes. But whether or not the God of creation has any plan for redemption for humankind and what that requires of us, that's something that would be revealed to us. It's not something we would know by reason. And so they accept, I think broadly within that tradition, they accept the distinction between reason and revelation. And what does that mean? Well, within the separation of church and state, that means that the activities that we take in community to live together are activities that take their bearings from God the Creator, not from God the Redeemer. And so we can allow people to determine, I think this is entirely compatible with what you get from people like James Madison and Thomas Jefferson when they're talking about religious toleration, that the duties that you owe your creator, as Madison talks about it, are ones that would be based on your understanding of God the Redeemer as revealed to you. And you would owe that in a certain kind of way, but it would not be the principle that structures the political community. And this, I think, is arguably why in American politics you find public appeals to God frequent throughout, and public appeals to the creator. But very, very infrequently, any kind of public appeals to Jesus. Well, why? And I think there's a consistency to that that operates and develops from within the Christian tradition that can make sense of it. And so just kind of fast forward a little bit, we're now out of the founding era, but Abraham Lincoln is a great example of this. So if you do a search for Lincoln in his collected works, you'll find 300 or so invocations of God. And if you expand that to Almighty or Creator, something that you'll get more. But very infrequently would you get any kind of reference to Jesus, and it's always for a political purpose. He'll appeal to this idea that the house divided against itself can't stand, but he's putting it to political use. And in Lincoln's speech at Hartford, Connecticut, he says that the wrong of slavery can be proved by natural theology apart from revelation. And so this is, it's a very common way actually for people to think about those things and how they relate to each other. Now, the question I think is revelation, and we have to specify which revelation or which purported revelation, but would the idea of revelation be incompatible with the authority of reason? And somebody like Jefferson probably say yes. But other people, James Wilson goes to great lengths in his lectures on law to say no. And so that's up for debate. But I think the idea that you could take your bearings from reason and appeal to the God of creation as something known by reason and not known by revelation, that seems to be perfectly compatible with the Christian theological traditions that are influential and with the broad sweep of American history and American civil religion.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the contemporary debates around Rawls and public reason and religion. I mean, it's almost like what it sounds like you're saying is that there's a kind of public reason in the founding that involved a kind of, sort of basic commitments to creation and maybe providence, which is an interesting element. But then there's also compatible within that sort of, private conscientious appeals to revelation, which it admits of like disagreement and pluralism, right? That there you could have multiple different kinds of views about revelation. Is that, and so you could, in other words, marry a kind of rational sort of approach that gains a kind of consensus with a sort of pluralistic view. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I
Thinking
think
about
that's
that.
helpful. And I think you do see that. So, for Jefferson, for example, when he's laying out what will be taught at the University of Virginia, he does not want to have sectarian religious classes, and he doesn't want to have clergy on faculty. But he does want natural theology to be taught as part of the moral philosophy curriculum. And so, you can see the way in which theological ideas for them are, they're part of philosophy and they're taught as part of philosophy, this idea of natural theology. And so they certainly, I think, did not have a view of reason that would say reason either knows nothing about or can make no inferences about the divine. But they would put some things as outside of what reason could discover or know. And those would be the kind of revealed religious doctrines that that people hold to. But if you go to the curriculum of the colonial colleges, which I had mentioned earlier, there's a guy named James Walsh who wrote a book in the 1930s about the colonial college curricula, and it's super interesting. He makes the case that it was really scholastic, and I think persuasively shows the way that a lot of these medieval ideas survive into the moral philosophy classes that are taught to the founders in that era. But if you look at what they were teaching, John Witherspoon is one good example of this. He taught the moral philosophy class to the students at Princeton. People like James Madison and a whole host of others took those classes. And you look at his notes, and he begins his moral philosophy class with natural theology, with our knowledge of God. And why was that important? For him, it was important because you had to first make sense of moral obligation. Where does moral obligation come from? Why do we have moral obligation? And he gets right into these questions about God's nature and creation and how we know. And he treats God's existence as something known by reason, as a kind of basic knowledge that we could expect people to know. And so, what do we do with that? Tom West, in his book on the political theory of the American founders, acknowledges this point and then says, well, the founders, they had to attribute to God the authority for our moral obligations because they knew that without God, there is no moral obligation. And I think, Tom's, his own position on this is that, and of course, there is no moral obligation. And the founders knew that. And because they knew that, they had to tell the people that God wills you to act this way. That might be true, but it still kind of underscores this point that they were really well aware of the philosophical debates that are going on and the importance for moral obligation of having some kind of transcendence.
Yeah, so maybe you could say a little bit about the revolutionary period. The next couple chapters you have in the book are about the revolution, and it essentially that the colonists and the Americans came to argue, essentially justify the revolution on sort of natural law foundations. And then you have a very interesting chapter on so the use of diplomacy and intelligence gathering that invokes regularly sort of claims to providence. Maybe you could discuss those elements and point out to us where you see those the sort of natural law elements in there.
It's one of those helpful times when having a co-author, you can point to your co-author doing that work. And Cody had really done a lot of work on the espionage chapter. But the really interesting thing about that, I think, was trying to figure out, okay, how do we test, if providence is one aspect of this, that truly believing in a providential God who intervenes in the world does set it apart from a kind of deistic understanding or pantheistic understanding. How do you go about testing for that? And one thing that jumped out to Cody as we were working on this was that in the private letters going back and forth, particularly in the community doing espionage in the revolution, there were, it seems, quite frequent and honest appeals and attribution of certain events to divine providence. And so there's a whole chapter that goes into that. And you were talking about the debates also and the way that these play into it. One example, it's pointed to a lot and it's illustrative of some of the other things going on, is Alexander Hamilton's pamphlet, his contribution to the pamphlet debates in The Farmer Refuted. But Hamilton is a young man. I think we still debate exactly what year he was born, but he's, 19 years old or so, and he's a student at King's College, and he writes a pamphlet in response to Samuel Seabury, who's the Episcopalian bishop, or the, I guess the Anglican bishop, who is, writes his own pamphlet, and he makes a cameo in the Hamilton musical. And Hamilton then writes this response to him, and in defense of the revolution. And in it, he has this. I mean, there are a couple of things that come out in Hamilton's reply, but I think this is an important part. One, he accuses Seabury of being a disciple of Thomas Hobbes. And in that context, in 18th century political rhetoric in America, that's a put down. And so he accuses him first of being a disciple of Thomas Hobbes. And why does he say that? Well, he says it because he thinks that, or in the view that he attributes to him, that in the state of nature, there's no moral obligation. And there isn't moral obligation until political authority comes into being. And so Hamilton then accuses him of a kind of veiled atheism because he discounts moral obligation. And then he says this in the pamphlet. He says, "But the reason he ran into this absurd and impious doctrine was that he disbelieved the existence of an intelligent superintending principle who is the governor and will be the final judge of the universe." It's a really striking passage to get from the 19-year-old Hamilton writing this. Did Hamilton believe that? I don't know. Was it in the air? I would think yes, certainly. Is this the kind of thing that he's talking about in his moral philosophy class at King's College? I think almost certainly. They're really well aware of some of these questions, and so he is attributing a belief in a moralistic God who has a causal relationship to the world as extremely important for understanding our moral obligations, and then he's discounting this argument against the revolution on account of that. So that's the kind of thing and the kind of example that we pull out from a lot of the different pamphlets. And every once in a while you'll see the historians who wrote about the revolution in the middle of the 20th century often would discount the role of religion in structuring beliefs, or the role of theology in structuring beliefs. And I suppose if what you mean by that is that they weren't all citing, Romans chapter 13 before launching into their pamphlet debates, although some of them were, then maybe you can set some of that aside. But the theology is everywhere. It's all over the place in all the pamphlet debates.
Yeah, well, this might be just a version of the question I asked earlier about reason versus revelation or natural theology versus revealed theology. But yeah, how much did they, if you were put a percentage on it, this is unfair maybe, but like what percentage would be the kind of appeal to a biblical authority, and what percentage would be an appeal to sort of natural, rational authority? And does that matter in your mind?
I don't know if it matters. I would put the, when it's an appeal as an authority that really makes a difference in how they view the arguments, I would put the majority of it on reason as opposed to revelation. Some of the books that have come out recently about the founders and the Bible, there's one book called Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers by Daniel Dreisbach, and there are a couple others in that genre. They do point out just how much of a biblical culture people lived in. It was a biblically literate culture, and their allusions throughout the writings are often to the Bible, and they quote scripture all of the time. But a lot of those allusions are to things like the idea that, every person will sit under his own vine and fig tree. Some, passage that George Washington loves to quote. And so, is that appealed to as an authority that makes a difference in the argument? Well, probably not, but it does demonstrate the degree to which they're kind of Bible reading people, and they get those allusions. They also look at models of polity that develop among the ancient Israelites in really interesting ways, and take those as models and talk about them, and make arguments against kingship based on the Old Testament. They're also, there's a kind of necessity here, because if you're responding to something like the divine right of kings, then you have to respond in kind. And so they're also making, if you're going to respond to Robert Filmer, you kind of forget that the first treatise is essentially biblical exegesis from Locke, because he's responding to a theological argument from Filmer. So by the time that gets to the founding, what do you see? There's not an easy dividing line. They're all mixed up together. There's tons of arguments appealing to tons of different sources. But I think the thing that remains influential in a dominant kind of way is the appeal to reason. But that appeal to reason includes within it an appeal to natural theology. And this is, I think, one of the places where I still struggle to pull the strands apart when people ask. So, one question you haven't asked, I appreciate you not asking, but I'll bring it up, is, to what extent does Christianity matter? If it's an appeal to reason, and if it's natural theology, and if it's a kind of classical tradition, how did Christianity influence it, or what does it matter? And I suppose my answer to that has been, well, these arguments don't happen in a vacuum, and they happen downstream from Christianity. And so it's not simply an appeal to classical sources, though, of course, many of the founders love the classics and they appeal to them. But the arguments just couldn't help but have been shaped by centuries of reflection within a Christian context. So what does that look like? Well, I think there's a greater appreciation for individualism. I think there's a kind of greater appreciation for mercy and some of the virtues that come out of the Christian tradition. And there is also just a framework that includes centuries of theological reflection on these questions. And it'd be very, very hard to isolate or pull apart the two things. And so that's the title of our book, is The Classical and Christian Origins of American Politics, and trying to highlight those strands and how they remain influential.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, in a certain way, and this points ahead a little bit to the final question I'll ask you, but about the contemporary resonance of that, because it seems to me, well, the discourse has changed a little bit on these, right? Because you do regularly hear sort of claims like, well, Jesus said X, therefore Y, or Muhammad said X, therefore Y. That is the appeal simply to kind of revelation in order to ground a view about like school prayer or abortion or whatever, with I guess without the equivalent sort of grounding also in a kind of natural theology or a kind of rational argument. So am I right? I mean, I don't know if I'm right about the contemporary landscape on that, but I'm trying, is that right, if it's sort of drawing a contrast then between the sort of public discussion around religion and the founding and in the contemporary world?
Yeah, there's so many different roads we could go down on this. One thing that seems to be important for the modern world is a theological rejection of the natural law tradition by certain Protestant thinkers in the 20th century. And then certainly, I think there are a lot of strands within Islam that look this way as well. And the idea is this: you get this from Karl Barth, is the theologian in the 20th century who I think is arguably the most influential on this score. Karl Barth's a Swiss Reformed theologian who argues that within his own theological premises, he's a Reformed theologian, and he says that our minds are fallen, human nature's fallen, but our minds are fallen. And because our minds are fallen, reason's not reliable. It's not totally unreliable. Because it's totally unreliable, everything we know, in the moral world at least, is known through revelation. And so it's really just divine command. It's God's command to us. And why should we understand what God's commands are? Or why would they look anything like what we would think is reasonable or rational? And so there's a kind of submission to the inscrutable commands of God that demands the believer's allegiance and discounts the idea of natural theology and natural law. That was really influential for a lot of Protestant theology. And I think that's one of the reasons why we now think of natural law as a Catholic doctrine or as a Catholic phenomenon. It's because Protestants, by and large, broke from that tradition in the 20th century. So fast forward to today, what does that mean for all the debates that we're having in American politics? Partly, if we discount the authority of reason or the reliability of reason, and we're open to the idea of a divine command, then it does lead to a place that you're talking about where, what else do you have other than the commands of God to base your judgments on? And, if John Rawls comes to you and says, well, that doesn't count as public reason, why would you have any sense that you should care what John Rawls has to say? And so there's a total rethinking of a lot of these things. And our book is pitched to certain audiences. I think it'll resonate with some more than others, but at least part of who we're thinking about are people who take the claims of religion seriously, but reject the American founding, which seems to be a more and more frequent phenomenon where people are saying, look, the founders were hostile to Christianity, they were hostile to religious belief, they were deists, they dismissed all of this, they were trying to inaugurate this secular age, whatever it is, and on that account reject the founding and want to go back to something before it and find some medieval model of polity to go back to or something like that. So we're trying to recover the theological richness and depth of the American founding and try to make the case for the way that it actually gives a, from within the theological tradition itself, can give good grounds for things like individual rights, religious liberty, limited government, constitutionalism, the things that are all seemingly on the table again today.
Right. I think of a book here, and you do cite it in your book, but Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed, where it's essentially right, like the view is, John Locke created liberalism, which is on a kind of from the beginning inexorable slope towards a kind of commitment to autonomy, ultimately to the sovereignty of the self over any authority in the world, and ultimately to a kind of nihilism and a sort of self-destructive slide. And I mean, maybe from the perspective of a kind of 20th and 21st century sort of expressive individualist lens, that might have a kind of resonance to it. But yeah, I take your point. That is that from the perspective of the founding, there's very much there's strong resources in the intellectual resources in pointing to a kind of form of rationalism, which has a has an important strand in the Enlightenment, the kind of contrary to Hobbes' view that that finds some resources to fight against that simple secularization thesis. So that seems right.
Yeah, and so you have somebody like Deneen will emphasize the focus on individuals and individual will, a kind of voluntarism in the American founding, and see that as everywhere. That is what the American founding is all about. And the American founders are liberals in part of this liberal tradition that really goes back to, Deneen's work goes back to Machiavelli and maybe arguably goes back to the Reformation, depending on what we're dating exactly in the 16th century. And so I think I'm of the mind that, yeah, if that were true about the founding, so much the worse for the founders. And that's what I think the conclusion a lot of people came to. But my argument is that that's not true of the founding, that if you actually look at what they're arguing, there are strands within it, of course, that you can find. Like anything else, it's a mixed bag. But I think the dominant tradition is not that. It is one in which they're well aware of the moral and theological debates, and they're coming out fairly decisively on one side of those debates.
Good. Yeah. Let me ask you a question about a concept that doesn't come up in your book, or maybe I missed it, but I guess the notion of civil religion, and what you think the kind of place is of civil religion. I mean, so you're talking about sort of the theological backdrop to sort of principles of the American founding and the American Revolution and various thinkers. I mean, civil religion is a kind of institutionalization of those principles, which has a kind of resonance in American history, and it has its own sort of history in America in modern political thought. I mean, do you see, what role of civil religion do you see as sort of coming out of the theory you're laying out in your book.
Yeah, we get into it just a little bit in the conclusion, and Robert Bella is the one who popularizes that notion for American politics. But as we look at it, this is part of what I got into with the kind of broader theological tradition emphasizing knowledge of God, the creator, versus knowledge of God, the redeemer. That in America's political or civil religion, I think arguably there are appeals to God the Creator, and this is the Declaration of Independence is one example of that. And of course, the Declaration goes on to appeal to God as a sovereign and God as judge. And so it's not just and God as providence, not just God the Creator. But those appeals to God in American history are frequent. I think this idea of civil religion could be understood in one of two ways. One is that it takes some kind of natural theology and makes it relevant to the political order and becomes part of the sacred symbols and rituals of American politics, but in a way that's not subversive or replacing a kind of deeper religious commitment that people might have. And another way is to see it, I think, in a more subversive light, that you replace people's religious commitments with something that attaches them to the civic order in order to ensure civic peace, or something like that. I don't think that's what's going on in America, although certainly there are people that don't have their own religious commitments who would nonetheless be perfectly fine with some kind of a civic religion that they could make part of their public life. And yeah, that seems to be a very common thread. There's a lot to try to pull apart with that in American politics.
Yeah, so just to I guess finish up on thinking about the contemporary upshot of your book. I mean, maybe you could say a little bit more. I mean, we already sort of have been started to talk about this, but what you take to be the contemporary upshot of the book. We're recording, it's a sort of yeah. I've been thinking about the IVF ruling and in Alabama and I mean that there's been a constant sort of jurisprudence over the past 50 years about the role of religious faith in the public square, prayer in schools, and religious exemptions to various rules and regulations in the United States. I mean, so how do you see your sort of project as sort of interacting with kind of broader American trends with regard to religion and politics?
In so many different ways, the one religion remains extremely important for American politics. And so, 20th century social scientists had this thesis that we would just become more and more secular over time and that religion would wane in influence. And that just hasn't happened. Hasn't happened in the United States, hasn't happened globally. It remains a force and it remains important. And what do we see today? I think two broad phenomena. One is the rise of identity politics, which arguably takes on a kind of religious cast and inverts some theological ideas and secularizes them, but then puts them in the service of this new identity politics. And so that's a phenomenon that we see. In some ways, we see that on the left, or we might consider that a phenomenon on the left, but in other ways, you see a version of that on the right as well. And the version on the right comes in the form of, I don't know if Christian nationalism is the right phrase for what we're talking about, but to the extent that you adopt an identity based on religion and race, but it ends up being on the right or ethnic group or whatever it is, and you become one more identity group vying for power, then that plays into that broader framework. And then you have people who are also arguing for a reimagining or reintegration of the realms of the civic order and ecclesiastical structures in really formal ways, and rejecting the US constitutional solution to that problem. And so I think those things seem real. They seem like a moment where whatever consensus there might have been on fundamentals seems kind of everything's on the table. And especially for young people, they're willing to rethink everything. Is constitutional government good? Would it be good to have one person empowered? Would it be good to have the civil government serve as the secular arm of the church? Should we rethink the whole Enlightenment project altogether? and go back to something that happened before it or go forward to something that happens after it. I mean, it seems like a moment where there's a lot of instability. And so we're, you know, our small contribution to the conversation is trying to point back to something that we think is really a rich intellectual and theological tradition that undergirds this whole project and trying to rethink foundations in an important and healthy way.
Yeah, that's helpful. I'm not a part of these groups, but I guess as I understand the argument is, and this comes up from folks like Deneen again, once again, is that it's hard to roll back the clock to a kind of American founding era approach to this because of the historical trajectory and direction of modernity. That is that. You know, there often, I think, is among these groups a kind of philosophy of history where it has a kind of logic to historical development and modernity, where there is a kind of, even you see this in, I mean, you mentioned Protestantism, that is that, you know, you start with a kind of Martin Luther view about sola scriptura, and then it becomes ever more gradually internalized and individualized and abstract, the kind of theology, until you kind of get like a nothing burger at the end of things. And so, you know, I mean, I think the worry on the right, is that, you know, it's all well and good, this sort of return, but we can't return. I mean, so it makes me wonder if you, I mean, do you have a, is there an equivalent sort of lesson or approach to the left too? That is that, you know, the left should, you know, that it shouldn't be a, I mean, a Rawlsian approach to these things sort of evacuates public reason of all sort of theological resonance, and so maybe it should invoke some.
I agree that you can't go back. And, you know, in life, you can never go back. You can only go forward. And so, as you're going forward, trying to be equipped with knowledge of the context in which you're operating, I think is the important thing. So, a lot of what people are debating right now is a kind of genealogy of how we got where we are. People are trying to diagnose the current moment, and they're going back and telling stories about the past, about how we got here. And what I think is important about the founders and the founding is the model that they provide for how to think about certain questions and how to apply it in their context. They're, you know, you're thinking through those questions with them in a way, and they become a really helpful model. Does that mean we have to provide the same answers to our problems today? No, I don't think so. And that's not what they were doing. You know, they loved the Glorious Revolution, but they didn't spend all their time just trying to recover the exact framework and arguments from that time. They were operating in their own moment. And we have to do the same. And we can't go back, but if we can retrace our steps and rethink some of the arguments, I think it puts us in a better position to think about how to move forward. It reminds me a bit of G.K. Chesterton has an old line about if you see a fence before you take it down, you should try to find out why it was put up in the first place. And so there's an element of that. I think when our institutions feel under siege and unstable, it's good to try to go back and think about why they were constructed the way they were in the first place, to recover some of those founding arguments. Not because we're tied to them forever, we can't disagree with them, or that we wouldn't have to apply them to our own context, but because it gives us a better understanding of our current moment and how to move forward.
Well, that's a great place to end. Justin, thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
All right, thanks, Jeff.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.